she was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2000. Treatment was in time. It had spread to a lymph node when it was diagnosed. But her real aha moment came a decade ago when she found that our trusty immune system can turn on us, can actually enable cancer to spread. Barbara Ehrenreich today is ignoring the preventative screenings. She's done with sterile medical office suites. We're looking at longevity and what we're really striving for here. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Barbara Ehrenreich is a writer, journalist, and author. At least 21 books under her belt, depending on how you count. Her new one is called Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying, and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer. Barbara Ehrenreich, welcome to the program.
Oh, I'm glad to be with you.
Well, your book made me think a lot about whether we are actually allies to our own parents when we're with them for those doctor's appointments later in life. You know, those physician visits, I always found myself siding with the doctor, encouraging one more surgery, encouraging one more round of intensive physical therapy, just the right cocktail of medications. But maybe we weren't really listening or understanding what is the outcome we're trying to get here. Who's in charge?
Well, we should be in charge. And I wasn't thinking about this consciously, you know, a few years back when I started being very skeptical about all the tests you're expected to undergo when you're over 50 or even over 40. But I have this very skeptical mind, and I started doing a little research on each thing they wanted me to undergo. And the results were enough to discourage me from a lot of these tests, most of them. And I'm talking about doing a little research into what biomedical scientists and doctors are saying about them. I'm not talking about coming from an alternative perspective or anything, just a simple, straightforward, scientific perspective. And a lot of the tests that we accept are, in fact, so questionable that even, you know, medical societies are rejecting them.
Well, early in the book, you write that you're presenting the dystopian view of the human body. Can you explain what you mean by that and how that really lays the groundwork for your book?
Well, I began to notice and think about the fact that our notions of the human body tend to be very optimistic. The scientific view has been of the body as a machine with all the parts working together neatly. The alternative, holistic, et cetera, point of view has been the body is, it's not a machine, but it's some kind of organism where there are different parts, but they all work in harmony. So there's been this notion that the body is a harmonious kind of place. You know, every cell in it is doing its job. Every cell in it is like a citizen in a communist dictatorship. Got to do this. You know, got to stick to your job, and everything is sort of
very cut and dry, cause and effect.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of ways in which you could describe our bodies not as harmonious, but as scenes of conflict between different cells and groups of cells. For example, cancer itself, now it may be in many cases, so not all, triggered by some environmental or lifestyle problem. It's a group of cells or even one cell deciding to go rogue, deciding they don't want to be part of that dictatorship anymore, and just like running wild and reproducing going around the body until, of course, they foolishly kill the body in the process. Autoimmune diseases. Now, those are cases where the immune cells decide to attack different organs of the body, different parts of the body, with disastrous effects, of course. And then the various things associated with aging, which are now more and more traced to inflammatory processes. In fact, the new word is inflammation. We age because different the inflammatory cells, which are immune cells, turn against us. Arthritis, for example, coronary artery disease, diabetes, all these are diseases that can be traced to our parts of our own bodies, microscopic parts, turning against us. I call that treason.
Well, and it's interesting, too, that you're bringing in your background holding a doctorate in cellular immunology. You've written about so many other things that are a far cry from that doctoral degree there. But when you bring it all back, at the end of the day, Barbara, what drives us? What drives us humans to try and live the longest lives we can?
Well, I'm questioning that. I mean, especially in the last 20 or so years, I've noticed my contemporaries increasingly devoting their time just to prolonging their lives. They kind of curate their diets. They think about every single bite and is it a good thing or a bad thing. They get very involved in exercise regimens. I exercise too, so I am, you know, I'm part of that. But not to the extent that some of my people I know at the gym are, for whom it's a major part of their lives. And then we have all these preventive care screenings to undergo at the doctor's office. So you really can spend your time, once you get to a certain age, and assuming you have health insurance, you can spend all your time just on your body and on your life.
Well, and you get at a point there. Perhaps this is more of an elitist perspective. I mean, here's the author of Nickel and Dime saying, you know, I'm done with healthcare, but there are so many millions of Americans out there who don't have access to quality healthcare or who can't afford a deductible, can't afford a premium.
Yeah, that's part of what makes this also grotesque. We in this country have healthcare expenditures skewed very much to the elderly, because we, the elderly, have Medicare. Meanwhile, there's very patchy care for younger people. And one of the things that has alarmed me just recently, when I found out, is that the maternal mortality is going up in the United States. Now, that's, you know, the mortality of women around or just after or during childbirth. Now, that should not be happening. Maternal mortality has been going down for decades, and now it's trending up again, probably, most likely, for lack of access to prenatal care, especially among Black women. And so we're not... Meanwhile, elderly and affluent people are being pressed to have more and more tests, which might do nothing at all.
What do you see the consequences, then, of this?
Of which part of it?
The part of it that perhaps the focus is off here, that we're in the focus also being that it is skewed toward people who can afford it, middle, upper class.
Yes, and who are old enough to get Medicare.
Right.
Another part of this. But, you know, it's possible to face both of these problems. One, that we don't have enough medical care for people who need it, and two, that a lot of the things on offer as useful medical care are not. I've always been involved with women's health issues, and what was said from the beginning, years and years ago, was we want everybody to have health care, but not exactly the same health care. We want to increase the access, but we want to increase the quality, too.
Author Barbara Ehrenreich is with us, and she's set very clear boundaries with her primary care doctor. That is, she will go to the doctor if there's a problem, but there's no exploratory anything to go searching for a problem. We're talking about Ehrenreich's new book, Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying, and Our Illusion of Control. That is here on The Morning Show. You have a line at 800-642-1234. Almost 24 books published over the past half century. What do you want to ask Barbara Ehrenreich? Call in. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment right here on the Ideas Network. Author Barbara Ehrenreich holds a doctorate in cellular immunology. She goes to that cellular level to better understand why we obsess so much about death. And at age 76, she's ready to talk frankly about it. The book is Natural Causes. You have a line, 800-642-1234. Do you think we're putting too much emphasis on the quantity of our years rather than the quality of them? Is our healthcare system taking away too much control from our basic decisions? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Cindy, who is waiting in Belleville. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Kate. Barbara, I've been hearing you make the rounds of the NPR programs, and thank you for visiting Wisconsin this morning. My favorite book of yours was Brightsided. For those that haven't read it, the subtitle is How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America. And I'm wondering what you think of this emphasis on positivity in our culture and how it ties in with our overconsumption of medical care when we are all elderly.
Thank you. That's a good question. In this book, Natural Causes, I take on some of the sort of siblings of positive thinking, like mindfulness. And, you know, again, taking a scientific look, what is the evidence that it actually changes people in any good way or changes their health? So I'm working in that same tradition of looking for things that we tend to all believe are true because we're told it again and again, but where the evidence isn't really strong. The idea of positive thinking was that you can control, I mean, among other ideas, you can control your health and your body with your attitude and mood. That drove me crazy, frankly, when I was being treated for breast cancer. The expectation that if I wasn't really cheerful and optimistic, I would die. I call that blaming the victim. Well, I wasn't cheerful or optimistic. I was really angry. And still, you know, I'm here 10 years later. So I think there are things we cannot control with our conscious minds. And yet we're constantly sold the snake oil of complete control. That if you eat the right things and think the right way and smile enough or whatever, you're going to live forever or live for an awfully long time.
Barbara, so much of the conversation around health these days revolves around that buzzword of wellness. What do you hear when you hear that word?
Well, two things. One, for, you know, most working people, white collar and blue collar, wellness is a scary word, because when your employer introduces a, quote, wellness program, it just generally means that you have to opt in to a certain kind of surveillance, being weighed, maybe having your blood pressure taken every month or so by the employer's physicians. And if you don't do that, you will be penalized financially. This was all based on the idea that employers could save money for their employees' health insurance by doing this kind of monitoring of, like, especially weight. I would extremely resent that if it was imposed on me, and many employees are outraged by it. Anyway, that's your lower class kind of wellness. At the upper reaches of socioeconomic class, you find wellness as a luxury product. It's something that you do for yourself. You invest in yourself with these things. The best-known example of a celebrity wellness guru is Gwyneth Paltrow.
Mm, right.
Who sells all kinds of really silly-sounding and expensive things that you can do with your body. And the most outrageous was getting steam to go in your vagina and doing that on a regular basis. That there was no evidence that would do anything. But then there's the wellness guru in L.A., Amanda Bacon, who has become famous for her line of skincare products, and I guess she has things, certain elixirs to drink too.
Go ahead.
You're so eager to get off to the.
I was good. Well, we got a lot of calls who are waiting for you, Barbara. Do you want to? Okay. Let's take another call. Let's go to Paul in Greendale. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I just wanted to mention that as my wife and I turned 50 in the past few years, we encountered both of our doctors saying, okay, here's this round of tests you now need. And I'm shocked. And I think, why do I need these tests? Well, you're 50. You need a colonoscopy, for example. And I say, I don't drink alcohol. I don't eat red meat. I exercise. I eat a high-fiber diet. And there's no history of colon cancer in my family. Well, you need one. And I think, maybe the European approach to medicine might be a little bit better for the two of us, because it's less invasive, doesn't cost as much. Their approach is very different, and their health outcomes are better. They live longer.
Yes.
That's all I wanted to comment.
Paul, thanks.
I mean, I looked into what I could find out about colonoscopies. They are really overdone in this country, and they're very expensive in this country. You can pay $10,000. If you go to Europe, you find them much less common, much, much cheaper, and it's not the first thing they do. There are non-invasive ways to detect the beginnings of colon cancer. Those should be used before making somebody go through a colonoscopy. So I completely reject that.
Let's bring in Linda now, who's waiting in Stoughton. Hi, Linda. What's your question?
Hello?
Hi, Linda. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, first I would like to thank Barbara for all of your work. It's just always really thought-provoking and contributes immensely to my life. I'm actually an herbalist, and I train other herbalists. And what I wanted to bring up and just see what your thoughts are around the natural health industry that plays into this, because I see a lot of things out there that people are being encouraged to ingest, especially lots of supplements and things. It's a huge industry, and it feels like it's playing into what you're talking about as much as conventional medicine. So I just wanted to see what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question, Linda. So vitamins, essential oils, Barbara, what do you make of it?
Well, here too, the evidence is just not strong enough in so many cases. I used to take certain supplements as they became popular at different times, like vitamin E had its moment, and I forget what else. Oh, I took B for a while. And then it would turn out that, no, it's not a good idea to get the supplements, that you should be getting these nutrients from your diet. Is that right, Linda?
Yes, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah. Linda, thanks. Yeah, thanks so much for the call. And Barbara, at a point in your book, too, you take your child to the doctor for a pretty bad cold or some ailment, and the pediatrician is prescribing a round of antibiotics, and you question. Can you explain what happened there?
You know, my little son was sick with a cold, and it wasn't going away. So I went into the doctor, and she said, okay, I'm giving him antibiotics. I said, oh, so you think this is a bacterial infection. Most colds are viral and are not affected by antibiotics. And she said, no, I don't think it's bacterial, but I always do this for nervous mothers. I thought, what? You know, I'm not the one taking the pill. What is this? You know, I said, no. Of course we're not going to do antibiotics for no reason.
Do you see an overuse of antibiotics today?
Oh, of course. I mean, that's a major problem. The production, encouragement of antibiotic-resistant microbes, because there are so many antibiotics around.
Let's bring in Eugene joining us from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning. Good morning to your guests. I grew up right after World War II, myself and my two brothers. And from late spring to late fall, our lunch would come out of the garden. We'd go eat some radish, potatoes, carrots, tomatoes, wash them off in the water tank, and go. And we walked a mile and a half to a one-room country school. I did for 8 years anyways. But I'm pushing 80. And I say eat good food, mostly organic. I raise my own garden, mentally and physically. I'm in pretty good shape. And you mentioned emotionally. Once in a while, I get ticked off at people. I also get depressed once in a while. But I'm still substitute teaching. And I'm getting along just fine. I just got done catching a cold, but I'm pulling out in about 2 or 3 days, pretty much. But stay on a good diet, good food.
Eugene, thank you so much. So Eugene found that going back to the garden, the garden plot, Barbara.
Well, it sounds good to me. I bet you have great salads. But I'm not sure we can all do that. I mean, I'm not going to do a garden because I have a bad back. But I think a lot of us, who are from a sort of the same generation, you and I, we can be very busy. We can be very involved in a lot of things when we're in our 70s or 80s. And the assumption often of the medical system is, hey, you're old. You've got time on your hands. You know, you can come and wait in my office, and then we can follow up some minute change we found in a CAT scan or something. No, we don't have a lot of time.
Do we need to stop viewing age as an enemy?
Feeling age as an enemy?
Yeah, stop viewing age as some kind of enemy in our lives.
Well, yeah, I mean, age is a good thing. I mean, I got this far, 76 years old. There have been a lot of near misses along the way, bullets dodged, metaphorically anyway. And, you know, this is me now.
how am I going to see it as an enemy? Age. Yes, there are disabilities and discomforts that come with normal aging. But as I said, we have a lot to do. The assumption is that we don't. And as we get older, time becomes more precious to us. We don't want to waste it doing silly things or things that are not going to help us in any way.
It seemed to you had a lot to get off your chest in this book about aging, about what's been on your mind, certainly since breast cancer, but also the article that you said changed you very much in how the cells in the immune system and our immune systems work against us in our body. But looking more broadly there, you've written a lot of books. This one seemed very personal to you as you approach your later years in life and perhaps informing what you want your own children to start thinking about.
Well, it's more personal, but it's also more scientific. Here I am returning to the subject of cellular immunology, cellular biology, which I had left like 40 years ago. Now, I've always read popular scientific magazines and things, but I don't work in a lab. I'm not interested in doing that sort of thing anymore, but I'm fascinated by biology. So that's what I was returning to.
You also spend time with your picking up your grandchild. You write about picking her up after school. And, she's at a very pivotal age, at age 13. What do you talk about with the next generation? And in your own family, what do you tell her about aging?
Well, I don't tell her things, but I think I may be some kind of an example. I have limitations that are imposed by aging, but I'm trying to work my way out of them in the gym and through physical therapy. And she knows that's a huge struggle for me. But really, you don't talk to 13-year-olds. You listen to long, involved tales of eighth-grade politics.
What have you learned through the tales of eighth-grade politics? How do they inform you?
Well, it is fascinating. They're like they're mean girls and in girls and out girls and so on. But what I have a great privilege of being around my grandchildren, and I hope to have more of them soon. Through these years, so I have been able to relive some of the most wonderful parts of my life, which was when my kids were young. And I also have lots of other things I work on. And they know that, and they're supportive, and they're wonderful.
How do you strike a balance between working, writing, finding the next idea versus, you know what, I can sit back here. I can enjoy retirement.
You could. You could enjoy it. Katie?
Yes. I'm trying to understand how you approach it, because here at 76, you would want to perhaps step back a bit. And I know you're saying, no, time is scarce.
Yeah, but that's whether I'm busy or not. Time is kind of scarce.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm running out of it, right?
Hmm.
But yeah, I have a lot going on in my life, a lot of cause that I'm very devoted to, which is helping younger, poorer writers and journalists get a break and get into the industry, if you can call it that these days. So that's a big cause for me, among others, and takes a lot of my time. But that's also part of facing aging. By helping younger journalists in various ways, helping raise money for them, helping them develop their ideas and stuff, I am reproducing myself in a way. I am creating new people or helping create them who will do the kinds of work that I have done, writing about economic justice, writing about economic inequality, and that's my project. I have to pass the torch.
Author Barbara Ehrenreich has set very clear boundaries with her primary care doctor. That is, she will go to the doctor if there's a problem, but there's no exploratory work being done. Now, we're talking about Ehrenreich's new book, Natural Causes, here on The Morning Show. And you have a line to her at 800-642-1234. What do you want to ask Barbara Ehrenreich about aging? Do you think we're putting too much emphasis on the quantity of our years rather than the quality of them? Is our healthcare system pushing us toward the idea of longevity at any cost? Is it time to reconsider the way we think about death? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And stay with us here on the Ideas Network. How is it possible that our own immune systems can become accomplices in the deadly project of cancer? Author Barbara Ehrenreich comes back to that question in her new book, Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying, and Our Illusion of Control. And we're talking about the book this hour on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're having a conversation about our health, why there's this tendency to control every aspect to it. It's a question that was an outgrowth from her approach to cancer treatment, prevention, and how to eke out more life. Barbara Ehrenreich stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we're putting too much emphasis on the quantity of our years rather than the quality of them? Let's go to Larry now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Larry.
Good morning. Good morning, Dr. Ehrenreich. I have a similar background as yours. I'm also an immunologist. And I just wanted to, I appreciate your very well-formed values for yourself and your healthcare values. But maybe I want to inject a little bit of balance here and say, when we start talking about tests like mammograms and colonoscopies, healthcare policy has to be based on statistical data. It's up to each individual to make their own choice. And clearly, there's a very much an element in our healthcare system of defensive decision making when it comes to routine screening tests. But they do have value for many people, and certainly I agree. A 95 or 100 year old would probably not be well advised to undergo a lot of invasive exams, but for the bulk of society, we really, these things are a cult in many cases, particularly when we talk about colon cancer. And let's not discount the value of those statistical analyses in healthcare policy.
Larry, thank you so much for the call. Let's get Barbara to respond to that.
Yeah, Larry, I salute you as a fellow immunologist. But that's what I'm looking at here. When I say I do research about different tests, I am looking to see whether they are evidence-based. That is, whether they hold up under very careful statistical scrutiny. The tendency to do this is just, it goes back to the 70s, when a mathematician actually started looking at medical decision-making and decided it wasn't based on science, usually. It was based, and here I quote him, on jello. There was just not enough to go on. Now, there is debate, like mammograms, a lot of debate. But I am impressed that there is so much evidence suggesting or showing that countries that do more screening mammograms do not have lower mortality rates from breast cancer than countries that do less. And same with colonoscopy. That's the kind of thing I'm looking at here. And if I may refer you to a good book on this, it's Overdiagnosed. That's the title, Overdiagnosed, by Gilbert Welch and his colleagues at Dartmouth University Medical School.
Larry, thanks so much for the call. Let's bring in Calvin in Madison. Good morning, Calvin.
Good morning. I want to ask what you think of the epidemic of iatrogenic disease in America and where that might be going in the future.
Good question.
Iatrogenic disease. And first of all, Barbara, explain that.
It's disease that's actually caused by medical procedures, right?
Yeah, that's by doctors. Yeah,
that's what you're looking at. I don't have numbers on that. But I guess that's one of the big things I worry about. So that's not something I went into, but it's very, very interesting, very relevant. For example, if you are suspected of having cancer, they're going to do a lot of things to you. They might do probably ending up in a biopsy, which is a serious procedure, a surgical procedure. And everywhere along the line, something bad can happen. I would think that some of the ways that prostate cancer is dealt with really constitute, you know, iatrogenic disease. When so many men have had their prostates removed, even though the cancer might never have, grown more in their lifetimes, but have the prostates removed and then find they're incontinent and suffer from erectile dysfunction. How is that we're going to call that iatrogenic? I sort of would.
Kelvin, thanks for the call. Barbara, what do you think could help us have better conversations around aging, around death, around dying?
Well, I think we have to first bring it out into the open. To be able to talk about death and dying. And not just, so many people, they'll shut down the conversation by saying, oh, we're all going to die. Hey, that's the reason why we should all be able to talk about it with each other. You know, that doesn't shut down the conversation. Why don't we talk about this? Why aren't we able to face it together and talk about our priorities for the time that we have left?
Let's bring in Ellen now in Milwaukee. Ellen, hi.
Oh, hi. I just had to check if I'm on speakerphone. Sorry. Hello, Ms. Ehrenreich. I want to tell you I'm a long-time reader of yours, and the reason that I respond so strongly to you is, to me, you tell the truth, even when it's uncomfortable, even when it's about a subject like aging and death that we don't talk about in our society. I'm almost 70 myself. I want to be honest in my aging process, and what you said about being angry when you were sick really, really caught my ear. I have to tell you, I really thank you for saying that we are not totally in charge of our luck. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your truthfulness.
And Ellen, you're a home care worker, home health care worker?
Yes, I'm on my way to a client right now who is actually younger than me. Yes.
Do you have these types of conversations with your clients?
I have more with some clients than I do with, friends and family, actually.
More honest, more intimate conversations about death and dying.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, and about being sick and about how it hurts and how angry you are, you know?
Barbara, how difficult is it to be able to talk more honestly and openly about this with family members?
Well, I guess I've been bringing it up for a long time. one way or another, often sort of jokingly, just to be sure we all know, you know, that I'm not going to be here in all likelihood in 10 or 15 years. You know, I just think that should be out there. And that in the time I have on Earth, I should have poured enough love into my grandchildren and my children and other people I'm very close to so that that will help sustain them when I'm gone. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. Ellen, thanks so much for the call and for bringing that up. Let's go to Joyce now in Spooner. Joyce, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I think that she's doing a great disservice to our community. I have 12 siblings in my family. I have 4 left. They all died of cancer because they didn't see a doctor and have these tests. So what she's saying is don't have these tests and you'll live longer. I really disagree with her. And before my siblings died of cancer, there was never any cancer in our family. So she's saying that if you don't have cancer in your family, you really don't need these tests. You do need tests.
Joyce, we appreciate the call. Barbara, what would you say to that?
Oh, I'm not telling you, Joyce, not to have the tests. I'm telling you that there's a lot of controversy about the tests. And in the face of that controversy, I have decided not to do them anymore at my age. I feel a little differently about my own kids, for example. But I think you can't say your siblings died because they didn't have the tests. We don't know that. We don't know the causality in these sorts of things. You know, they might have died anyway, and I would be very concerned about whether there are any environmental factors that led to so many members of one family dying of cancer.
Barbara, you write about our fixation to assign blame to a death, so to speak, especially if a person dies at an early age. You call this the biomoral autopsy, where we start asking questions like, did the person smoke or drink excessively? Did the person have a poor diet? Where is this coming from?
Well, because we associate health with morality, health with virtue in this country. In fact, it's almost replaced other forms of virtue. I mean, the highest form, I guess, would be the vegan person who eats no gluten and what are healthy other things, drinks nothing but kombucha, whatever that is. That becomes those people can have a sense of virtue about them. And so we think that way. I think it's crazy to be moralistic about health, in part because there's a lot we can't control, as my whole book shows. But, you know, when David Bowie died, the obituaries just said cancer. They didn't say which cancer. And that upset a lot of people. Who wanted to know exactly what it was so that they could, you know, figure out what David Bowie had been doing wrong all his life. He certainly smoked a large part of his life. But we tend to blame people. And I think we should just get over that.
Oh, yeah, like when you read an obituary, you rush to find out what was the cause of death.
Yeah. And then you say, maybe she didn't need enough fiber.
Has writing this book changed the way you think about your own death?
Well, I'd already been thinking about that all my, I could say back to the age of 13, when it occurred to me how strange it is that we live and then we stop, then we're gone. And yes, I talk at the end of this book about a different perspective on dying. A notion that the world is beautiful, the world is alive, and it will continue just fine without me. That's what sustains me.
But that is really difficult to swallow for some people, that they're not essential.
Well, but we can't, if we think we're essential, how can we die? I mean, one of the things that's been a big part of my life is the feminist movement, you know, working for women's rights. When I go, others are going to take my place. They're already doing it. When I'm not here to write brilliant little witty comments on the political situation, there are plenty of other people, younger people, who will do it. So I feel that my being here or not is not that important to the world.
Was it difficult to arrive at that conclusion? I mean, now you're at peace with that, but that's been kind of a lifetime of getting to that point or not?
Well, I guess a lifetime of getting to that point. But if you get a little bit outside of yourself, thinking self, 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 me, 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 and you start seeing the world around you and all the people in it, it changes.
What piece of advice would you give us as we think about death and dying and try to make some, maybe perhaps single or few changes in our life as we think about that stage?
Well, I would think about what's important to me, or as we say now, what's my passion? You know, what do I want to see happen? And what can I do to advance that in the time I have left? So it's about priorities, but getting out of just thinking of yourself, your body, your every twinge of feeling you have, and thinking of the larger world around us.
That there are many other people around you, and it's not only you.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm very busily passing the torch to younger people all the time in the work I'm doing. And boy, does that feel good.
Well, Barbara Ehrenreich, thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Barbara Ehrenreich is a writer. She's a journalist, author. Her new book is Natural Causes, An Epidemic of Wellness, The Certainty of Dying, and Killing Ourselves to Live Longer. This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina and Keely Baltina. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this visit with Barbara Ehrenreich, you found it on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.